Good evening, everybody. My name is Veronica Entwistle, and you've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. What is a paradigm shifter? Is someone who's making a difference in the collective, changing the consciousness of our species at some level. And we have an amazing paradigm shifter with us tonight, a techie wizard and a spiritual man who's done a great invention and is helping people's brains balance out, become more of what they really are. Welcome to the show, Lee Gerdes.
Thank you.
This is quite a book. You've just put out a new book called Limitless You, which is, I'm interested in being limitless.
It is, in fact, limitless when you start getting beyond your patterns, you know, your automatic functioning.
I want to ask you, I'm jumping around because I have so many things in my head that I want to talk to you about. Tell me gently, or tell the people in a clear way, what is the difference between the mind and the brain in your world? Because you're doing a lot of brain research. But what is the difference?
In my world, the brain is simply a computer network. And it provides the processing as would a computer provide processing, but the mind is that which adds value to the and discernment to that process.
Okay.
And so,
the mind doesn't have to be in the brain, does it?
No, I don't think it is on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's so intertwined that if the brain is far out of balance, the mind will have a very difficult time in discernment.
Well, that's a good place to start, and we'll probably return to that subject, because I think a lot of us talk about that quite a bit these days, the mind and the brain, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you talked about being out of balance, and the examples that you had that are very intriguing to me is that people can be hurt, perhaps, or in shock, maybe even in utero, and act kind of normal, but there's a built-up, a pent-up kind of reality going on in the brain itself, which can mean that they'll act out and become violent teenager or something. Is that about what you'd say?
That's certainly a possibility, yeah.
So let's talk about balancing the brain, or if you could talk about even some more examples like that, but how we can be very, very unpredictable, or we can seem like not good people because of the state of our brain.
Yeah, the value on our quote-unquote goodness generally is put upon us by the world based on what we do, I guess, how we act and react in various situations and what we do with our life, with our personal lives in terms of optimizing them. So if I'm struggling all the time in my day-to-day life, because I have an imbalance, you see, and I have to use X percent of my energy because of that imbalance, then that X percent is not going to be available to me to direct towards other daily life or optimizing myself.
So then I might be frustrated and behave in ways that are antisocial.
In fact, it could be so bad that let's say the imbalance caused you to have parasympathetic dominance in your autonomic nervous system. And I know those words sound a little far out, but the autonomic nervous system is simply the internal nervous system that drives the physical functions of the body.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you don't think about your heart beating, but it does, or your lungs, you know, taking in oxygen, but they do. They do that automatically. So the autonomic nervous system has a stop and a go. For me, coming from the Midwest, it was more like the being at a carnival. You know, we had these ducks that went around, and you picked a duck out and got a number and got a prize. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Yes, we have.
I might be too old for that for you, but anyway, that's what we did. And in that water that made the ducks go around in that oval-shaped trough, there was one water that shot to the left in the back, and there was one water sprout that shot to the right in the front, so the ducks would continue to go around in that trough.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more or less what happens in the autonomic nervous system. The brain drives part of it to come back and part of it to go out. And that part that comes back, or we'll call it the brake, one acts like the brake, the other the gas. If your foot's on the brake too much, then the only way you can get the vehicle to move or get yourself to move is to slam your foot down on the gas. And so that, in the personal experience, is what we see as rage.
Hmm.
Or an outbreak of anger.
But an unexpected one?
Well, it builds up, and it often happens very quickly. So yes, in that sense, you could definitely call it unexpected, yeah.
Hmm.
In other words, the reaction is much stronger than the situation would warrant.
Well, I know you have some wonderful examples of that. Maybe we should ask for those first, because I don't want to distort where I'm going with this. You have some examples of people. I remember reading about one who was a man, I think, in his 60s, who had been exhausted all of his life.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that story? And the right side of his brain had been impacted by some kind of trauma or shock when he was little, and he didn't know that until after... Until he was a lot older.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are varying ways of seeing that trauma or shock. In other words, it could be anything from being hit as a child or as an adult on someplace on the head. It could be trauma that we pick up even before birth from a stressful situation in the environment. There's just a very large number of possibilities.
So it can be mostly shocking. Well, we don't know what creates a limitation, but it's about limiting the brain's capacity, right?
Yes, and what the brain does, it shifts into a pattern to help it survive. So let's say we talk about a boy here called Justin,
mm-hmm.
and he... Justin had the cord wrapped around his neck at birth. And so what his brain did in order to keep him alive as a fetus was to conserve all of the energy for itself. And so his extremities weren't able to move. He wasn't able to see or hear very, very much when he was born. But he was alive, so his brain picked up patterns to keep him alive. Now, his mother worked with him for the next 23 years until the time when we saw him, and she taught him to move his upper body. She taught him to, you know, to speak and to have some cognitive functioning for sure. But he couldn't see, he couldn't move his lower extremities. But when we saw those prints in his brain, those trauma prints from that experience, and then we showed his brain itself without those prints, it gravitated to create new networks. So, in time, Justin was able to see for the first time in his life, read, and became proficient at it in a very short period of time.
But he actually could get his eyesight.
Yeah, he's verbally skilled now,
hmm.
Incredibly skilled, actually.
Hmm.
And he's going to school, and he wrote me just a couple weeks ago that he's got a girlfriend. So.
Well, let's go back to what exactly you did. Did you take a picture? I know it's called neurofeedback, in a way. Is it?
Neurofeedback is a science, underlying science. Neurofeedback is actually about trying to teach the person how to control the brain. Brain state conditioning is about how to teach the brain to optimize itself. So what we do is we take actual brain waves and we translate them into an optimized wave pattern, and we show the brain itself in that way.
So what do? Do you have electrodes? Do you have...
They're called electrodes. Actually, we at BrainState have developed these. They have computer chips in them to take interference out, because you're talking about a very small amount of electromagnetic energy inside the brain. So it, any interference, as you might guess, could distort the picture. So we have we've developed our own electrodes that place on the scalp, non-invasive,
mm-hmm.
and they see the electromagnetic patterns that are happening underneath them.
So you can see where someone's brain has been stopped or shocked.
Yes, and surprisingly, you know, we knew that for a long time. With trees, for example, we could see in rings of a tree how a storm had hit thousands of years ago, perhaps.
Wow. Yeah, I guess
and
I knew
so,
that. Mm-hmm.
And we can see in the brain pattern how a storm hit as well. Only that storm we see in the brain pattern, we don't know the cause of. You know, it could be what the brain perceives as trauma, or it could be literally a trauma.
So you don't know if it's physical or emotional or mental or whatever.
Precisely. We don't know that. Hmm. But we do know it's there.
So when you discover what the patterning is, then what you're saying is you observe it, right?
Right.
Let's talk about how observation in quantum physics is a very dynamic tool, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's the tool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we all know it. It's true anyway. I mean, we've all walked somewhere sometime, and we felt somebody looking at us. And we've looked over our shoulder, and sure enough, they were.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
So we've all had that experience. And
so at the very least, it made you turn your head.
Yeah, yeah. And so it changed you. That which was observed was changed. And that's the double-slit theory of quantum physics. And that's the theory that I began with when I tried to observe the brain in a pattern that was more optimized in the areas where it was really imbalanced.
So... First of all, let me ask you why on earth you started doing this. Weren't you a techie wizard?
I was, but I had a problem.
Oh, good. That always gets us learning, hey?
Yep. The the mother of invention is need.
Mm-hmm.
And I had post-traumatic stress.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Were you in Vietnam?
I had post-traumatic stress from being assaulted about 9 years before, and I went through every conceivable modality to help rid myself of those symptoms, and couldn't get there.
Hmm.
So I used different kinds of talk therapies. I used I was a cognitive therapist. I used different kinds of drug therapies. I used EMDR and emotional freedom technique, and I used biofeedback and neurofeedback, and I could help myself some, but...
Did you become a cognitive therapist in order to help yourself?
No, I was that before.
Okay.
So I should have known something about it, and I just could not believe that it was me.
Hmm.
It did not make sense. There was something askew that had nothing to do with me. And so when I started hooking myself up with electrodes and observing my own brain when I felt good, and then hooking myself up in the same place and observing my own brain when I didn't feel good, there were a huge disparity between those two.
Did you begin that because of biofeedback?
Yeah, I began it because of I certainly did neurofeedback, and that technology was a simple way for me to begin hooking my brain up and looking at it.
Hmm. And then what happened? Like, how long did it take to notice the difference?
Well, it probably took me a few weeks. I sort of played with it if you know what I mean.
Experimented.
Yeah, I found it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I wasn't feeling good, I would take the pattern, let's call it an area, a frequency range. I would take that range, and whenever I had a dominant frequency in that range, even when I had static or wasn't feeling good, I would play that dominant frequency back to myself in the form of a note, a musical note.
Oh, really? So how did you do that? How did you make that translation?
Well, I picked up the frequency from my brain and put it through a computer and wrote a computer program and made it there.
Okay.
And so, you know, my brain finally said, oh, why didn't you tell me? Yes.
So what are you saying? That actually, that tone, it was like a tone, right?
It was a musical note that represented the frequency. I used sound to show myself my own brain, yeah.
Hmm.
And we still use sound as our major media channel for showing the brain itself.
So what's confusing, wait a second, it's very interesting, but it's like you're reflecting back to your own brain pattern, but you're doing it with something which actually, just like observation can change the brain, the sound will, get in step, harmonize, release the density, or what?
The sound will start showing the brain itself in a different pattern. Because I'm not showing it all of itself. I'm not showing it the static.
Okay.
So let's say you have a mirror in the bathroom that's heavily fogged over from a hot shower, and you take a towel and rub it off so you see you have a spot in it. Well, it's the same thing that I'm doing with looking at a spot for the brain to see itself.
And the brain likes to adapt, doesn't it?
That's what it's made for.
Mm-hmm.
And the more it does it, the better it likes it.
Well, that's interesting. So the plasticity. Are you the one that coined? Who coined plasticity? The brain.
It wasn't me. It was actually some scientists from San Francisco. I'm sorry, I forgot their name.
Hmm. But it's so, isn't it?
It's totally so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
How's your PTSD?
Well, what happened was I was living in Minneapolis at the time. It was winter, and they got a lot of snow there. And I was walking down the sidewalk downtown. The snow was piled up, so it became like sort of a hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody ran out from the building and bumped me in sort of in the back. And I started to laugh because I remembered that only a few months ago I would have been totally ready before that. I would have been totally ready to attack that person.
Wow.
And now I was standing there laughing, and then I thought, gee, this is good.
I must be all better.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is when you're talking, I'm going, I bet you weren't better. You were improved, weren't you?
Precisely. What
do I mean? I mean all better, meaning as if you were sick. You weren't that. You were more evolved or...
Yeah, I was given options that I didn't have before.
Right. Even before your assault.
I was better. My children tell me that I'm much better after brain training than before.
Hmm.
But I frankly didn't see it all myself. I mean, they will tell me what the difference was, but I didn't understand it. And the reason, and we have a lot of people like that as clients, the reason you don't understand it is because what you're doing is automatic function. You don't think about it. There's no volition. So when you shift to a new phase or a new state of automatic function, you don't necessarily know that you're doing it in a different way.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
Let's go back to the sympathetic and parasympathetic functions. You talk about at the beginning of the book, and that was really interesting, that in the parasympathetic, if the assault, for example, the assault would have a bigger impact on the parasympathetic, is that right?
Well, It will depend on what the situation is. For me, the assault had a bigger impact on the sympathetic. It was infringement, and I was hyper alert. I was on hyper alert all the time.
Hmm. And you didn't know that, or you did?
Well, I knew that, but so what? I mean, I couldn't do anything about it. I wanted to do something about it. I didn't want to live that way.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's hard for people to know what's real, especially when you talk about automatic function. It's hard for people to know who they really are and what is changeable, isn't it?
Extremely.
So I have two things. I know a young woman who's very, very bright and so on, but she holds back all the time, and even as a child, you know, she would hold back riding horses. She would hold back all the time, playing with the other kids, anything, hold back. And I always thought it was a trauma that she'd had as a wee one when her dad got terribly ill and everything was rather chaotic.
Probably.
So when I read that section about the freeze,
yep.
I'd like you to speak about that. But then I went, I think that's my friend. Problem, if it's a problem. I think it's designed her life to a degree.
So some major categories of trauma we see in the brain, one of the categories is isolation and abandonment, which creates a dominant parasympathetic imbalance. And that means that the person, the standard response for that is to freeze. So that's what Justin did. As a fetus, there was no movement.
Mm-hmm.
There was no kicking. There was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people will sometimes do when they are with a loved one who dies. They will sort of freeze. It doesn't seem possible. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about the comparison between that and somebody who was, say, battered as a child or raped along the way or something.
Well, that's infringement.
Okay.
And that category, that means that they're very hyper-alerted.
Right.
And so they're
these are all protective devices in the brain, aren't they?
Precisely, yeah. And they're, you know, and that battering, that battering as a child will make them generally to be sympathetic dominant. And there are various pathologies that go with each one of these things, too, by the way.
Hmm.
Because they do totally affect the body.
Well, what, and I'm referring to one of the cases in your book, a young man who seemed okay, but then he was planning to shoot up a whole bunch of people, and they caught that and got him into brain training. Do you remember,
uh-huh.
that? Remember that story?
Yes.
And I think you said he had trauma in the 8th month of his mother's pregnancy.
Correct.
And they were going to release him earlier from the womb or something.
Yeah, they were trying to induce her because they thought she was going in labor when she had a severe indigestion.
Hmm. But it was interesting to me because that didn't, if I remember the story correctly, that didn't seem to occur. He didn't react in a weird way until he was going to be really out there, right? He didn't react as very weirdly when he was younger, did he?
No, he acted quite the contrary. He acted, he was extremely loving and, you know, cooperative. But he couldn't relate, and being a teenager is a tough world.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
And he was, not only could he not relate in a class, then he was made fun of, and he couldn't defend himself. He was in a frozen state. And that just built up and built up and built up.
So it was an alienation thing, hey? I think the way you wrote it was like the energy built up so that he would burst. Is that right?
Yes. And so he had to get out of that state. And of course, he initially, they saw him, the reason he was brought to us is they caught him using drugs. And most will try to use drugs in order to get out of the state. Because if anybody is severely imbalanced, the painfulness of the situation will, you know, cause them to do just about anything to self-medicate.
And the painfulness is like a real, what, an anxiety or a pressure or what is it?
And all the above.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimately that life just isn't worth it.
So you've had amazing success with drugs, I hear, right?
Yeah, it's been very amazing, actually. We have had about 1,000 people so far with who've been suffering from addictions. And have had a lot of success with them. And the addiction might include just about anything, but by far most of those were substances.
And what would you consider that? It's mostly teenagers or?
No.
Okay, of all ages?
Uh-huh.
The other thing is, when it is addictions, what do you see in the brain? Is it always the things we've been talking about, the trauma, the slowed down brain, the frozen brain reactions and so on? What do you see?
There's a definite pattern where you see there's a definite imbalance. And when you see that imbalance and start and begin to release it, then the need for the drug goes away. So it tells us that the need for the drug wasn't because of a bad choice. The choice was an attempt to balance themselves.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, it made sense to me. I was an adult child of an alcoholic father, and I never understood it before.
Hmm.
You know, he was a smart guy, and he could be very extremely creative, etc., but I just never understood it.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you understand when you started working on the brain? Was his alcoholism, did you work on his brain?
No, he had passed 10 or 12 years before that, but what I did was be able to come to some kind of resolution, an understanding that it wasn't his bad choice. It was his attempt to do the best he could to balance himself.
Self-medication. So as the adult child of an alcoholic, then you must have had your own learning curves as far as intimacy or getting close to people. And I don't need you to open your heart here necessarily.
Sure. All of us go through certain things.
And it's a basic problem with many people, that particular syndrome, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, I'm really finding out that a lot of those situations in life that we all face, some of us go through them very well, and some of us, because of other situations we face, don't go through them so well. To give you an example, we've had about now 144, I think, veterans who've come to us for post-traumatic stress. And some of those have been from Vietnam, but most, of course, are from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And about 136 of them or so are from the United States, and then the other 8 are from other parts of the world. What we see, though, for these people is that we see very distinct patterns which are causing their life to be distorted. Understand that when you're driving down a road in a vehicle and you see an old car on the side of the road, if you're in Iraq, you're going to swerve wildly not to get close to it because it's likely a bomb.
Right.
When you see the same thing happen in Phoenix and you're on a six-lane freeway, you know cognitively that it's like not likely a bomb.
Right.
But you still make the dangerous swerve. That is an automatic function. And that is what needs to be changed. That's an indicator that there's an imbalance.
Oh, you mean to make the dangerous swerve as if it's a bomb car?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Cut across six lanes of traffic and endanger your wife screaming and your child in the back seat.
Right. Yeah, I see. So the reaction isn't fitting the context. Tell me this. A lot of people have really extreme reactions to war. Well, a ton of us do, but sometimes it seems like the childhood or the history of the person has something to do with how extreme their reaction is with PTSD or post-war pain. Is that right?
Well, I suppose it could. I don't have, you know, I like to be a scientist, so I measure stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I frankly can't measure that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some things I can measure, if you'd like me to share a couple of those
with
you.
Yeah, I love
that.
Yeah.
One of them is the horrific decision that we've made for equality between men and women and putting women on the front line. The female brain is much more, has a corpus callosum or a center line, if you will, that's much more permeable than the male brain. And so the female can go from left to right and right to left very quickly, much more quickly, 2.5 times to 3 times more quickly.
Does that make us more empathic as well?
It does, and it also makes you better leaders.
Oh, wow, good for us. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make you better engineers.
Oh, okay.
So when the female comes to ask the male a question and he's watching the football game or something and he doesn't answer her, it's not because he's ignoring her, it's because he's male. But anyway, what we do is
we stop wagging our finger at him then.
Yeah. We've taken the female and put her into that environment. And she is very highly likely to be traumatized by it.
Hmm.
If there were 10 men and 10 women in a room, a bomb went off outside the room, then if two of the men had post-traumatic stress from that experience, 5 at least of the women would.
How interesting. So it's less about their background.
Well, it is their background, right? I mean, they became female when the egg was fertilized.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it was their background, but it's certainly not environmental.
Mm-hmm.
in other ways.
I see that, okay.
And
then do they recover as well? Do the women recover as well as men?
The women do recover as well. The women that most of the women, or at least half of the women that we've worked with, were also sexually violated. And by their own,
whilst they were over there,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
by their own soldiers.
Oh Lord!
And so they had to go out on patrol then, and that betrayal caused a very distorted brain pattern for them.
It makes me very sad.
The good news is that these men and women had the courage to go, and I hope the good news is that we're going to be able to help some of them they come home.
Are you still offering that? You were doing free work with vets, I believe.
Right, and we don't do free work anymore,
mm-hmm.
But we are trying to get the Department of Defense to work with us. And we think we're going to work with them in a research hospital so that they can provide that.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's very exciting.
I also met a young man, I think he was about 25 or something. He he is doing a whole bunch of work, having come back from Iraq. He's doing a lot of research on the amount of sexual abuse there is of young male soldiers.
Correct. We've had those males, too. And, again, males and females will have a different brain pattern. The female will be more traumatized because she goes back and forth, you know, much more readily.
What does that mean? I mean, like, does that mean that she can understand the whole picture in the middle of it all, or?
No, it means in the case I'm speaking, I'm just speaking in geek language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at brain function in terms of electromagnetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just seeing that energy display itself differently for her than for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. And she has more areas out of balance, and out of balance to a greater degree than he has.
Hmm. Oh my! Well, this is, and you do get a fair number of women. And tell me exactly how long the process takes, and is it different for everyone? What's it like?
We haven't yet enough, Veronica. We haven't enough data to be able to determine how long it's going to take for someone.
Mm.
Generally, what we've done for the vets coming back with PTSD, not those who were violated, but the others, those are usually 10 sessions.
Wow, that's not bad.
No. Sometimes they're 15, but usually 10 to 15.
And you can actually see results. That's how you...
We usually see results in the first one or two.
Okay, and you release them when you actually can perceive that their brain patterns shifted.
And then we just do the 10 sessions because that's like training the brain to develop its own new pattern, you know, and that seems to be sort of a very ready number of sessions.
Mm-hmm.
I think our average client is about 20 sessions.
Okay.
But Justin, the young man I was talking about earlier, who had the cord wrapped around his neck at birth, he's had about 60 or so sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have eyesight before. He couldn't move his extremities, lower extremities before, or, you know, a number of other things. So he's come a long, long way.
Well, that's a very exciting story. Thank you. The other thing is about eyesight. And do you ever work with people just on those subjects alone, like eyes and...
Well, all we do really, we don't work with any pathology, frankly. We only work with balancing and harmonizing the brainwave pattern. Now, sometimes we see that when there's a sight issue, but sometimes not. So, our research hasn't enabled us yet to go in the different direction and seek out a specific pathology in that light,
hmm.
But I think it will in the future.
It's interesting. We're talking about brain balancing, and I believe somewhere in the book I was reading how, for example, a brain that's unbalanced can be the brain of a brilliant artist or writer or creator of some sort as well, can't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading and going back and forth and going, I wonder... you know, like sometimes I'm very much a part of the learning about the soul's journey and the fulfillment of the soul, so I'm going, I wonder how much our destiny is linked with the way our brain is balanced, you know, naturally, you know?
You know, that's an interesting question, but I do know this, that there are places in the brain pattern where we see, when they're well balanced, we see people who are very much connected to themselves and to others and to the creation around them, and they make their decisions based on that connection.
Hmm.
And we see people when these are out of balance who make most of their decisions based on fear.
Hmm.
And we see what fear looks like. It has specific brain patterns.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. And so I think that the world around us is really a world where we make decisions based on one of two things, on love or on fear.
Hmm.
And as we make more and more decisions based on love, I believe we gain in consciousness.
Hmm. And do you think that changes the brain patterns or balances our brains?
Yes, totally.
Hmm. I love that. I believe what you're saying. The other thing I was reading about, of course I've read many, many things in this wonderful book, which is called Limitless You, The Infinite Possibilities of a Balanced Brain by Lee Gerdes. It's a wonderful book, Lee.
Thank you.
And I was pretty interested, because I am an intuitive, of your description of intuition, what it means and how. I think I read that you have to have a balanced brain to really be able to count on your intuition.
Yeah.
And yet I know that a lot of us who are in the intuitive or psychic world have gone through big traumas and somehow stepped out of our normal reality and then adapted to that. And that became the route to seeing, if you know what I mean.
I totally understand it, and I even know the brain pattern you're talking about.
Okay, can you talk about that a little bit? It's just so interesting.
Here's the problem. May I speak then about your field a little?
Please.
We actually see a number of people in your field.
Oh.
And the reason we do is because they can't turn it off and turn it on.
Uh-huh.
And it gets in their way for daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts to distort some of their, you know, execution. So, I don't know language to put around this yet, because it's still relatively new, but if you're too intuitive all the time without being able to execute, it's as if back in the 60s we used to say that person was a navel gazer.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
They were maybe a sweet person but inept at executing in the world. And sometimes that can happen with a great gift, and the great gift could be intuition. It could be some other things, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For instance, when we talk about idiot of savant, that's what generally we're talking about.
Mm. Well, I'll talk about me just for 2 seconds here, is that I had visions out of control, and I did a number of things to try and stop it, which were mostly nutritional studies, meditation, and physical movement. They got better and clearer, but the reason I'm telling you this story was because I had to learn to turn it off so that I could turn it on.
Yep.
Until I could learn to turn it off, it was taking me, and it was horrendous. It was.
Yep.
So I thought I'd share that.
And so it is that I believe that if somebody can get into a meditative state, they can work toward balancing their own brain. But the problem we see, particularly when the person is far out of balance, is that they cannot get there. You just can't get there from here.
Yeah.
You can't jump over the river. You can't do that. So you need some tool to get you through. You know, you need a boat or a bridge. You need something. And so we're the boat or the bridge. We're the tool.
Well, I want you to also talk about, I'm very excited about your work, incidentally, but I want you also to talk about, the last time you were on my show, you were talking about how you had groups functioning in different parts of the world or something?
We have 132 offices.
Whoa, that's quite a few.
And in 18 countries.
Great.
And, so what we do is we collect data from all of these places every night. So we look at brain patterns, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the fun part of this for looking at it futuristically will be in like 5 years or so, we'll be able to see how, say, the social decisions or social environments affect brain patterns.
I love that. part of my brain is very researchy, and that would be very exciting information. What about world trauma, like African? Are you working with any African people?
We have a couple offices in South Africa, but when you talk about world trauma, the place where I want desperately to work is the Native American reservation. And we're talking to one reservation now, and I pray that they move forward with us. But another place that is going to really, I think, make a huge change is Ireland. Ireland, you understand, had about 500 years of war. And all of that trauma left it to be, left the people to have inherited trauma patterns. And so what you see there is that, you know, you see a high rate of substance abuse and other pathologies associated with those patterns. And you see that same thing on the Native American reservation.
Yeah, we live on a little section that isn't Native, but we're on an Indian reserve. And we see it. It's really quite tragic at times.
Because we're talking about, for the Native American population, a very high percentage, well over half.
It's like they can't even metabolize some of the stuff that they're eating and living on, too. Doesn't that kind of, you know what I mean, is to have fast foods and processed foods and so on, they're not able to work with that either, are they?
Well,
Let alone the drink and the...
Right. You've got a very, very strong pattern of that's inherited for the most part, and then you're trying to medicate it. And what do? You can use alcohol, which turns to sugar on, right? You can use meth, amphetamine, which is a big hit. You could use sugar, which processes in that way, and carbohydrates, right? All of which are have their minuses toward health. But now you see, doing that for years, what happens is type 2 diabetes raises. You know, substance abuse raises. It's a huge problem for the whole culture.
It occurs to me as you're talking that all of this work with brain balancing is actually improving people's ability to value life.
Precisely.
So it's improving the mind, isn't it?
Well, as soon as the mind then can function, you know what the people in the, we worked with people on probation a number of years ago, and we worked with people inside of a prison last year in Nevada. And what invariably they told us after they had, you know, they were balanced, is they all said the same thing. I wonder why I did that.
So you're saying it was in the
It was an automatic function that they were trying to, I mean, they felt like they were going to implode, so they tried to self-medicate, or they exploded, or they did whatever.
And they don't remember the details of all that.
Well, they can remember the details sometimes, but they don't know why they engaged. Because, you see, if your toe doesn't hurt, but it did hurt a couple of weeks ago, I'll bet you don't remember it hurting.
Right, that's true.
You know?
Yeah.
And they do the same thing. All of us do the same thing, actually.
It's like my brain's hurting.
But that is precisely what they experience. And when that brain hurts, it causes us to go into a deep kind of need.
Wow. Well, this is such exciting, revolutionary work, isn't it?
It's a different way to see some of the world, that's for sure.
It's really wonderful, Leah. I'm very impressed by it. Would you like to tell people, and I like to learn about it too, would you like to tell people how they can get in touch with you or other practitioners?
All the practitioners are listed on our website of Brain State Technologies. That's our Brain State Tech, TECH.com. And you can find a practitioner near you there. And also, there you can, if you'd like to pick up the book, it actually sold out, I guess. Before it ever got to the stores.
Well, that's pretty darn good, and I can sort of see why.
And it will be in the stores about March, I guess, with the next printing and all. But we have some reserved yet, so you could pick up a copy of the book too if you're interested.
Excellent. And as far as coming to see you, I guess you already said that there are different practitioners in different parts. Is there a machine? Isn't there a machine that people need to, if they get participate in this, don't they have a machine ultimately?
Yes, all of our licensees, we license our technology,
mm-hmm.
and they all have all of the equipment, and we train them and certify them, and we also provide them ongoing support. So we provide them both technical support, so. The beautiful thing about the internet is that we can be here in Scottsdale, where, as you might know, is 60 degrees right now.
we want to know that. It's pouring rain here in Bellingham.
Sorry about that. But we can be here in Scottsdale, and we can get on any computer anywhere in the world in less than a minute.
Wow. And that's how you read the brain patterning as well?
Well, no, that's how we can help anybody else, but... Everybody's computer that they receive from us as part of the license has all of that software on it. And so they can do that reading wherever they are in the world.
Wow. What an amazing time in which we live, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
Well, I've so much enjoyed your visit, and thank you so much for spending the time with us, and I love your book.
Thank you very much.
And your work.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Thank you, and to you, and blessings.
Blessings to you.
Mm, bye-bye.
Well, that was a learning curve, at least it was for me. I love the art of changing the brain. Boy, oh boy, is there not hope for humanity, and Lee being such a compassionate and caring inventor fella. What a good show. Thank you so much for being on, Lee. So this is Veronica Entwistle saying that next week I have, and I forget his first name, is Friedman is his last name, and he co-wrote a children's book called Milton's Secret with Eckhart Tolle. And it's a really wonderful book. Milton's Secret is all about the light he keeps in his heart as he learns to live in the now, in the power of now. It's a wonderful, well-illustrated book. And I know that Mr. Friedman has lots to say about talking with children. And then on Thursday night at 8 o'clock on BBS Radio, I'm going to be interviewing Jackie Salvitti and the team. We're going to learn about consciousness and what it's like to be a multidimensional group of beings who are really helping us to wake up to our amazing potential as well, sort of like Mr. Gurdes. And it's the beginning of the holiday season, and I hope you're all having a wonderful time no matter what the weather is around you and enjoying the crazy energies that are flowing through the universe, kind of tickling our brains and our ability to become more and more conscious. Or resisted, as the case may be. This is Veronica Entwistle. I'm an intuitive and energy counselor. I'd love to work with you. If you want a session with me, email me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. Or if you have any comments about the shows, if you enjoy them, if you prefer to hear something else, if you have an idea of who would like to be on, please email me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. I'd love to talk to you about that. Or phone me at 510-595-5564. And in the meantime, we all know that it's love or fear. Let's send love to one another. I send out much love to all of you. Many blessings, and thank you for listening to this show. Good evening.